All right, we're still in slide 11, and we're talking about photosystems, but photosystems, both varieties, photosystem 2 and photosystem 1, are only part of this whole arrangement of structures. I don't know that there's a name for the entire thing, but this whole set includes photosystem 2, an electron transport chain, photosystem 1, and then a shorter electron transport chain. And this is just one copy. There's many, many copies. And it's embedded in the thylakoid membrane of a chloroplast, remember? Well, let's look at what's happening here. A photon comes along. Well, trillions and trillions of photons are coming along. And most of them are just wasted because they don't hit in the right place. They'll either go through the leaf or be reflected off. But if it's the right wavelength, and if it is lucky enough to hit any one of these pigment molecules, it doesn't have to be this one, it will be absorbed. And remember, we said that when a photon is absorbed, the photon no longer exists, and the energy goes into exciting the pigment itself. And therefore, the pigment has an electron that goes up at least one energy level. That's excitation. But the excitation gets transferred without fluorescence. No photon is created. Excitation just travels basically by resonance energy transfer from one pigment to another. The special pair of chlorophylls in the reaction center complex of photosystem 2 not only gets excited eventually, but gets super excited, meaning that it loses its electron, and that electron gets sent to the primary electron acceptor. That reduces the primary electron acceptor because it now has that electron, but it doesn't hang on to the electron long. It immediately delivers that electron to the first member of the electron transport chain that's between the two photosystems. In other words, the primary electron acceptor is doing the same job as the coenzymes did in cellular respiration when they dropped off their electrons to that electron transport chain. And also, the same thing is happening in this electron transport chain. It's not identical with respect to the members of the chain, but it's working the same way as the electron transport chain we looked at in cellular respiration, which means when electrons get passed from member to member of the chain, that's a stepwise release of energy, and that powers the pumping of protons through the membrane. It's just a different membrane now. We're talking about the thylakoid membrane rather than the inner mitochondrial membrane. But it's accomplishing the same thing. It's pumping protons, creating a proton gradient, and therefore storing the energy, or at least some of the energy, in the form of that gradient. The energy originally was in the light. Now it's in the form of a proton gradient. And it's doing that for the same reason that the mitochondrion was doing it, namely to allow then the diffusion of those protons back through the membrane to where they got pumped from, and that causes the spinning of ATP synthase rotors, which allows for production of ATP. It's exactly the same thing. That's why you have ATP coming out here. And remember from last time that I said the part of photosynthesis, overall part 2, which is when the sugar gets created, which is in the Calvin cycle, that Calvin cycle requires ATP. Well, here is a source of ATP for it, but coming from light energy, basically. Okay, now, the same thing is happening in photosystem 1 as far as excitation is concerned. This is a different photon of light that got lucky enough to strike one of these pigment molecules. Same thing happens. Resonance energy transfers the excitation. That's the black arrows. Eventually, this special pair of chlorophylls gets excited and loses its electron to the primary electron acceptor. And it goes down a shorter electron transport chain, which does not pump protons, and which does not create ATP. Okay? But this shorter electron transport chain takes those electrons and delivers them to an empty taxi. and it's a different fleet of taxis compared to the mitochondrial one, right? In cellular respiration, and well, complete oxidation of glucose, we used NAD and FAD, but NAD was the nicotinamide-based coenzyme. In photosynthesis, it's a different taxi company. It's NADP. So NADP plus, which is the empty oxidized form, receives the electrons from the shorter second chain, and along with protons, and that causes reduction of NADP plus into NADPH. Okay, that's carrying a lot of energy as well. If this happens, then both of the two required forms of energy, ATP and NADPH, get produced, which is exactly what the Calvin cycle requires. It needs both of these. Now, when the reaction center chlorophyll pair gets excited and loses its electron, that creates a very unstable situation. That pair of chlorophylls in the reaction center complex wants an electron back immediately. Now, it's not going to get that electron back, but it doesn't care. All electrons are the same, right? Point is, the electron that's removed from the reaction center pair of chlorophylls needs to be replaced. And notice what the source of that replacement electron is in photosystem 2, the first photosystem. The source is water. Okay, so enzymatically, a photosynthetic organism can split water into hydrogen and oxygen. It's doing that not because it wants the oxygen. Remember that oxygen is a byproduct of photosynthesis. It's doing it, splitting water, to provide a source of hydrogens, and the hydrogens themselves are sources of electrons. And this is a reciprocal relationship with the previous chapter, right? The fuel was a source of hydrogens. We dehydrogenated the fuel, to provide electrons and protons, which are, when they're together, hydrogen atoms. Similarly here, hydrogen atoms get extracted from water, which is an input, it's a requirement of photosynthesis. Plants require water. The electron that comes out of, or I mean, the hydrogens that come off of water get split into electrons and protons, and that electron from a hydrogen is what replaces the one that was just removed. So it returns it to a situation that's more stable, but also it means that once that electron is replaced, the same thing can happen again. If there's light still shining on this, it can be re-excited, and it will lose that new electron, and it will go down the chain. So the electron transport chain between the two photosystems is continuously working as long as there's still light shining and there's still water available as a source of electrons. The protons are also important, but they don't trickle down. They get pumped. Okay? Now, when we look at photosystem one, the second one, the same thing's happening. It wants an electron back as well, not the same electron, of course, because it's on its way down the second chain. But look what the source is for replacing the electron in photosystem one. It is the electron that's coming down through the chain between the two. So the electron that replaces photosystem one's reaction center chlorophyll came originally from the reaction center chlorophyll of photosystem 2. Is that all clear? Okay, now this will continue, as I said, as long as there's light and water. And what we're seeing operating here is the light reactions. The light reactions allow for the transduction or conversion of light energy into chemical energy in both forms required by the Calvin cycle, ATP and reduced coenzyme, NADPH. Now what I have just described occurring, which involves all of this as I've described it, is called, as a process, non-cyclic electron flow. And we give it that name to distinguish it from another possibility, which is cyclic electron flow. I'll get to that in a minute, but first let's look at 12, which is just a cartoon analogizing what's happening in the photosystems and chains. So the photon provides the energy like this hammer to excite an electron, which then gets rolled down this ramp, turning the mill. That's what makes ATP. Second photon excites this electron, but it's replaced by the one coming down the electron transport chain, and then the second electron transport chain reduces NADPH. Just a cartoon. If it helps you understand it, that's fine. But let's go to 13 now and talk about cyclic electron flow. I've described non-cyclic, but there is also a possibility of cyclic electron flow. Now, each set of structures, by which I mean both photosystems plus both electron transport chains, makes up one set, but there's trillions of copies of that. Each one can do either of the two processes. Each set can switch back and forth between running in cyclic mode or running in non-cyclic mode. So it's not that there's sets that specialize in one or the other. But the reason this is called cyclic electron flow is that the second electron chain is not operating. All right? So everything happens the way I described it before, except when this photosystem 1's excitation occurs, the primary electron acceptor does not deliver that electron to the second chain. Instead, it sends it back for another trip through the first chain. And that's why it's called cyclic. The electron keeps being recycled through this first chain. Now, notice that the first chain, as I described before, produces ATP. The second chain produces NADPH, but in cyclic electron flow, the second chain's not operating. Therefore, in cyclic electron flow, ATP only is produced, not both NADPH and ATP, just ATP. So you might ask, why would a plant do this? Why not make both? Especially when I told you that the Calvin cycle requires both. ATP by itself is not enough for the Calvin cycle. NADPH by itself is not enough for the Calvin cycle. So why would a plant do this, or any other photosynthetic organism? The answer is that while it's true that the Calvin cycle requires both ATP and NADPH, it does not require them in equal amounts. It's not a one-to-one ratio of these two things. It's like a recipe. You know, you need more of certain ingredients than others. The Calvin cycle requires more ATP than it does NADPH. What we'll see is that it requires, for every two NADPHs, it requires three ATPs. And therefore, if the plants were all, or the photosystems were always operating via, or in non-cyclic flow, which is what we looked at in the previous slide, ATP and NADPH would be made in equal amounts. It would be making it in an inappropriate ratio. You can look at it as either making too much NADPH if they do that, or not enough ATP. It's the wrong ratio. On the other hand, if occasionally you switch to cyclic electron flow, then you're making ATP only and not any NADPH, and that would be appropriate because that will make up for not making enough ATP via the other mode. Switching back and forth allows the organism to make a 3-to-2 ratio of ATP to NADPH. But how does this happen? How does the plant know which mode to run in? Well, it doesn't know anything. It doesn't have to. It happens automatically. Now think about non-cyclic electron flow. That's when both chains are operating. It's making just as much NADPH as ATP. But you can think of that as being too much NADPH, right? Because its Calvin cycle is using all the ATP, but it's not using all the NADPH because it doesn't need as much NADPH. And therefore, if it continues doing that, every one of the NADP taxis gets full because these taxis dump their electrons off at the Calvin cycle. That's where they unload. And if the Calvin cycle is not using the NADPH, eventually every one of the taxis is going to have passengers, right? Which means there aren't going to be any empty NADP pluses to come back to this second chain and pick up more electrons. Is that clear? Therefore, that's when photosystem one, this second photosystem, has no choice but to send the electron the only place it can go, which is back through the first chain for another ride. That's why this second one shuts down, not because the plant wants to, but because this chain is going to be full if there's nowhere to put those electrons because there's no empty taxis. Now, a little bit later, when after the plant is making only ATP because it's in cyclic mode, eventually the NADPH that had built up before is going to be used by the Calvin cycle. That will free up some empty taxis, and then that will automatically turn this second chain back on, because they'll be able to pick up these electrons, and it'll switch, therefore, from cyclic back to non-cyclic electron flow. By going back and forth between the two modes, the organism makes a perfect 3-to-2 ratio of ATP to NADPH. In 14, we're comparing the electron transport chain of cellular respiration with the electron transport chain between the two photosystems in photosynthesis. And they really operate exactly the same way, even though they use different proteins as members of the chain. What we're looking at here, though, is the diffusion of protons after that gradient has been produced. That is really identical in the two processes. What's different is where they happen. In a mitochondria, if you look at this box down below, this could represent either cellular respiration or photosynthesis, depending on how you label the diagram. If this box is representing cellular respiration, then the light gray represents the mitochondrial matrix. That's where the protons get pumped from. The dark gray represents the intermembrane space. That's where they accumulate. Then they want to diffuse back into the matrix, and they do so through ATP synthase molecules to produce the ATP. The same thing's happening in a chloroplast. It's just different names. Oh, and by the way, for cellular respiration, the membrane would be the inner mitochondrial membrane. If it's photosynthesis, though, the membrane is the thylakoid membrane. The light space from where the protons get pumped is the stroma, which is, remember, the fluid that's inside the inner membrane, but it's outside of the thylakoids. They get pumped into the thylakoid space inside the thylakoids, and then they want to diffuse back into the stroma out of the thylakoids, and they do so through ATP synthase to produce the ATP. Exactly the same use of a hydrogen ion gradient. Well, I should say that the difference as far as energy is concerned is that the energy is in photosynthesis originally from light. The energy in cellular respiration is from food, is from the fuel. 15 puts it all together. So this is a cartoon of the light reactions with the membrane and all the anatomy shown. This is vastly exaggerated as far as size is concerned, but this shows you one set of structures of many, many billions that are in a cell. So you have photosystem 2, photosystem 1. They're both being excited. The electron that's removed from photosystem 2 gets replaced by an electron that comes from one of the hydrogens of water that gets split. That electron trickles down through, or the electron that's lost trickles down through the electron transport chain, pumping protons and producing ATP. The second photosystem, photosystem 1, does the same thing, but it gets replenished, its electron gets replenished by the one that trickles down through the electron transport chain, and the electron that's lost trickles through the shorter second chain to reduce NADP plus into NADPH. The ATP that's synthase that's involved is situated so that the ATP gets produced in the stroma, not inside the thylakoid. The protons are pumped into the thylakoid space and then they diffuse back into the stroma or out into the stroma so that the ATP is produced there, which is where the NADPH is also produced. Well, that's appropriate because these two energy-carrying molecules are going to be sent to the Calvin cycle, which occurs in the stroma, exactly where they're produced. That finishes the light-dependent reactions, which provides for the chemical energy required by the light-independent reactions, which are also called the Calvin cycle. That's what's shown in slide 16. And the light-independent reactions make up the part of photosynthesis that accomplishes the goal of the overall process, which is to fix carbon, right? The goal is to fix carbon, produce organic compounds out of a carbon source that's inorganic, which is carbon dioxide. Well, the Calvin cycle, of course, is a cycle, but that's just a biochemical pathway, several different reactions that are arranged in a way that the ending feeds back to the beginning. Just like the citric acid cycle was a cycle, but this, of course, is a totally different cycle. What we see here is that the overall Calvin cycle exists in three phases, which are labeled here. Phase one is carbon fixation. That's when the carbon that's in the inorganic carbon dioxide molecule gets incorporated into an organic compound. That's what we consumers are not able to do. That's phase one. Phase two is a reduction phase, and that involves transfer of energy because it's a redox, right? Reduction is, of course, part of redox, but something gets oxidized, something gets reduced. Well, in the previous chapter, when we were trying to make ATP from fuel, the fuel got oxidized, and the taxis got reduced, right? Because the taxis were then going to carry the energy. Here, the taxi is already reduced. It gets reoxidized when it loses its electrons and protons, but the intermediates in the Calvin cycle get reduced. So when it says reduction phase, it's not the coenzymes that get reduced. The coenzymes get oxidized, but it's the intermediates of the cycle that get reduced. And that allows the carbon skeleton to gain hydrogens. Remember that the whole thing here is that the organism is trying to build a sugar, which is the organic compound. Phase three is regeneration of the carbon dioxide acceptor. In order for phase one to work, which is carbon fixation, there has to be something receiving the inorganic carbon source, which is the CO2. And in other words, there has to be a CO2 acceptor, something that accepts that molecule. And that molecule that accepts CO2 in photosynthetic organisms is called RUBP for short. I'm sorry. Ribulose bisphosphate. I shouldn't say I'm sorry, it was right. RUBP for short, but it stands for ribulose bisphosphate. Okay, ribulose bisphosphate, shown here in cartoon form as just the gray dots and the P's, It's more to it, of course, but we're focusing on the carbons here. Ribulose bisphosphate is a 5-carbon sugar. It's ribulose, so that makes sense that it's a sugar, right? 5-carbon sugar that has 2 phosphates on it. That's why it's called ribulose bisphosphate. Bis means 2, just like bi does. So it's a 5-carbon sugar that acts as the carbon dioxide acceptor. When a 5-carbon sugar accepts carbon dioxide, which itself contains 1 carbon, that makes a 6-carbon intermediate, which they didn't even bother giving a name here, just short-lived intermediate because it doesn't last very long at all. But that's what's happening here. We go from a 5-carbon sugar to a 6-carbon compound because we've incorporated the carbon from CO2. That's why it's carbon fixation. That's happening at the start-finish line. It's carbon fixation because now the carbon that was in the inorganic CO2 is part of an organic compound. All right? Now, as we go back, or as we go through the other steps, every so often as it's turning through these steps, a sugar gets popped off of the bottom here. And it's a sugar called G3P, which is also a part of glycolysis, if you look at the details of glycolysis. G3P is short for glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. That is the sugar that the Calvin cycle directly produces. It does. In other words, the Calvin cycle does not directly produce glucose. But once you have G3P, then 2 G3Ps can be combined into glucose. And that's why the summary reaction for photosynthesis involves glucose as an output, not just G3P. Okay, now back to this ribulose bisphosphate, which is the CO2 acceptor. Phase 3 of the cycle is regeneration of that. You have to have this on hand, this RUBP, in order to allow this cycle to continue, in order to take in more CO2 and fix it. Now, just like all steps of biochemical pathways, there are enzymes involved. And most of the enzymes are not listed here. There's an enzyme at every step. But of course, there's also an enzyme here at the start-finish line when ribulose bisphosphate receives the CO2. And that involves a very special enzyme, which is called Rubisco for short. I prefer, though, to spell Rubisco, which is an acronym, as capital R-U, capital B-I-S, capital C, capital O, as opposed to how they did it, just as a word. And that's to remind us of what the Rubisco actually stands for. Rubisco is an acronym for ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. So let's write that out. Now you can see why it's Rubisco. Ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. Well, the name, the full name, you can't tell from the nickname Rubisco, but from the full name you can obviously tell that it's an enzyme, right? These ASE endings. Well, actually, it's a double enzyme in a sense. It's a carboxylase, which is a type of enzyme, but it can also act as an oxygenase. So it's really 2 enzymes in one. But in terms of the goal, what the organism is trying to do is to fix carbon so that sugar gets produced. And that will happen only if Rubisco operates as a carboxylase. A carboxylase is an enzyme that carboxylates something. Well, remember when we talked about decarboxylation of pyruvate in the previous chapter? Decarboxylation is removal of a CO2. If you attach a CO2 onto something, it's not decarboxylation, it's carboxylation. And an enzyme to help for that is called a carboxylase. Well, Rubisco is the most important carboxylase. It's also almost certainly the most abundant protein in the world, because this is operating in all the photosynthetic organisms. Anyway, though, if it operates as a carboxylase, Rubisco will allow CO2 to be added to ribulose bisphosphate to make this short-lived intermediate in it. In other words, it will allow the cycle to turn. Importantly, Rubisco is not ribulose bisphosphate. Rubisco is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase, which is an enzyme that has as a substrate ribulose bisphosphate. Okay? In other words, this ribulose bisphosphate right here, that's separate from the enzyme. The enzyme is just named for the fact that this will work with the enzyme. Okay, now if everything goes well, then Rubisco operates as a carboxylase and carbon fixation happens and sugar is produced. But I said that Rubisco also operates or can operate as an oxygenase. An oxygenase, if it operates as an oxygenase, Rubisco will add oxygen to ribulose bisphosphate instead of adding carbon dioxide to ribulose bisphosphate. Well, that will produce the wrong stuff. Oxygen doesn't have any carbon in it, right? So if you stick carbon onto this last intermediate in the carbon or in the Calvin cycle, you produce not a six-carbon intermediate, you produce something else. You don't add any carbon, you're not fixing any carbon if you allow oxygen in instead of CO2, which is bad enough, because if you don't fix carbon, then you're not producing any food or any organic compounds. No sugars are produced. That's bad enough. So the plant would not want that to happen. But what's worse is that if you do add oxygen instead, then you have to spend time and energy getting rid of that oxygen so that you can convert it back into ribulose bisphosphate and try again and hopefully have CO2 come in instead of oxygen. But Rubisco can work either way. And as a matter of fact, Rubisco as an enzyme actually has a higher affinity for oxygen than it does for carbon dioxide. So if they are both present, which they are in air, right? Oxygen usually wins out. And if oxygen wins out, if oxygen gets incorporated instead of CO2, then we call that wasteful process photorespiration. Because it's kind of like it's comparing it to respiration when we take in oxygen for good, right? Well, here it's not for good. Taking in oxygen hurts the plant in terms of energy and reduced sugar production. But it happens often because Rubisco enzyme is actually more able to work with oxygen than it is carbon dioxide. Okay, photorespiration is a problem. Most plants that have to just deal with this problem, there's really nothing they can do about it, are called C3 plants. But they're not the only kinds of plants. There are a couple groups of plants that have gotten lucky enough to evolve solutions to the problem of photorespiration. Now, they do it in different ways, but how they solve the problem is essentially the same. What I mean is that the plants that are able to, the non-C3 plants, because neither of them is a C3, the non-C3 plants that have solved the problem do it the problem of photorespiration. They do it by separating carbon fixation, which is in a C3 plant, that's part of Calvin cycle, right? But a non-C3 plant separates carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, which produces the sugar. In a C3 plant, carbon fixation and sugar production happen as part of the same overall cycle, the Calvin cycle. All right? There are two different groups of plants, though, that do this. They've evolved separately, and they've solved the problem in two different ways. The first one that we'll look at is called a C4 plant. C4 plants are much more efficient because they don't have nearly as much photorespiration occurring, which is wasteful. Let's look at the anatomy here. In a leaf, remember that the leaf of a C3 plant, which is what I showed you on that when we looked at the leaf anatomy last time, they're just mesophyll cells in the middle of the sandwich. Here there are mesophyll cells in a C4 leaf, but there are also other cells that are right around these veins, and those are called bundle sheath cells. So these are bundle sheath cells because they form the covering or the sheath of this vascular bundle. Okay, mesophyll cells, notice, are more superficial, which means they're closer to the surface of the leaves, either the top or bottom of the leaf. So the mesophyll cells are closer to the air. The bundle sheath cells are deeper. They're deeper in the thickness of the leaf, so they are not right next to the air. The reason that's important is because the air is where the oxygen is, which is problematic, right? Oxygen causes photorespiration. Okay, so now we have a close-up of these two different types of cells. On the top is the mesophyll cell, on the bottom is the bundle sheath cell. In a C4 plant, there's a separate cycle called the PEP carboxylase cycle. The PEP carboxylase itself is an enzyme, but the cycle is named after it as well. And PEP just stands for phosphoenolpyruvate. You don't have to know that. Just saying in case you're wondering. Anyway, this first cycle, which is not the Calvin cycle, it's its own cycle, that occurs in a C4 plant in the mesophyll cells, and that's where CO2 comes in. So PEP carboxylase, this is a different enzyme. It's not Rubisco. It's a carboxylase, but it's not also an oxygenase. And that's why it solves the problem. PEP carboxylase will take in CO2, and it doesn't matter if oxygen is there or not because oxygen won't work. Okay? So that's why it matters that the mesophyll cell is superficial. This is where the oxygen is more likely to be, but it doesn't matter because it doesn't interfere with PEP carboxylase. So the CO2 gets fixed into an intermediate in this cycle, and those intermediates get transported through plasmodesmata to this deeper bundle sheath cell. All right? And one of these intermediates, which is malate, a four-carbon compound, that's why these are called C4 plants. This malate that's part of this first cycle then gets decarboxylated. That releases the CO2 that was taken in the other cell, but it releases it to the Calvin cycle, which is what is taking place in the bundle sheath cell. So really this first cycle is just a way of incorporating CO2 and then delivering it to a Calvin cycle that is farther away from the atmosphere and therefore is less likely to be interfered with by oxygen. So Rubisco is still working here, but since it's deeper away from the environment, this Rubisco is going to mostly incorporate CO2 since there's not much oxygen here. Does that make sense? C4 plants, in other words, separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle in a spatial manner. There's a spatial separation, meaning that the two parts occur in different spaces, different cells. All right. We see that again in slide 18. This left half is a C4 plant. So the separation of the two processes is spatial. But there are other plants called CAM plants, and that's all caps because it's also an acronym. CAM stands for crassulation acid metabolism. And I know that's a weird word, but CAM plants are named for the type of plant that was first discovered in. Crassulations is a group of plants. They're capable of CAM. That's what CAM was named for. There are other plants besides crassulations that do the same thing, but that's why it was called this, because of what it was discovered in. Anyway, CAM plants also solve the problem of photorespiration by separating carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle. But instead of separating it in space, they separate it in time. Instead of it being spatial separation like it is in C4, it's a temporal separation. Temporal means of time or in time. So it's the same cell here. It's the same space. But one of the two processes occurs during one part of the day and the other occurs in the other part of the day. That's a temporal separation. What happens here is that a CAM plant will open up its stomata at night. Remember, the stomata are the little openings in the leaves? And it will close those stomata during the day. Well, during the day is when the sun is shining, right? And most plants would want their stomata to be open so that they can have the CO2 coming in when it's light out, because that's when photosynthesis is taking place. But a CAM plant closes down during the day, which also, by the way, has the advantage of preventing a lot of water loss. During the day, that's the hottest part of the day. That's when you are most likely to dry out as a plant. Most plants don't have a choice, though. They have to be open and lose some water, because otherwise they can't take in the CO2. Well, in a CAM plant, they're closed down during the day. They open up at night. That's when the CO2 can come in. Now, oxygen comes in as well, but it doesn't matter because this first cycle works only with CO2. And so this first cycle is running throughout the night with more and more CO2 being incorporated. That's the carbon fixation step. And what that produces is a bunch of organic acids. That's why this is called acid metabolism. The carbon that is fixed from CO2 gets incorporated into acid molecules, which are really just a way of storing the CO2 overnight. All right? Then the sun comes out and the stomata close. That's important because when they close, no oxygen can come in. All right? No CO2 can come in either, but that doesn't matter because they stored a bunch of CO2 from the previous night. And what happens then is these organic acids that build up get decarboxylated. That takes the CO2 back out of them, and that CO2 gets sent to the Calvin cycle. And that allows for sugars to be produced. All right, you see the difference in how these two groups solve the problem? They both separate carbon fixation from the Calvin cycle, but C4 does it in two different spaces, two different cells. CAM plants do it in two different parts of the day. Well, that leaves only one slide for this unit, which is slide 19, and there's no new information here. I've given you all the information for this chapter. This is just a summary. It's worth going through, though. Remember that unlike the complete oxidation of glucose, photosynthesis occurs entirely within a membrane-bounded organelle. There's no cytosol part. Photosynthesis has two main parts that are occurring within the chloroplast, and those are the light-dependent reactions and the light-independent reactions, but you can also call the light-independent reactions the Calvin cycle. The Calvin cycle, part two of photosynthesis, is the part that actually accomplishes the goal, which is to incorporate inorganic carbon from CO2 into organic compounds, specifically G3P, but then it can be made into other sugars and then other molecules as well that aren't sugars. It can be part of a protein or part of a anything, any of the macromolecules we talked about. That goal, though, is accomplished by the Calvin cycle. That's an anabolic process because you're building up bigger molecules out of smaller ones, and therefore it's endergonic, requires energy. But it can't run directly by light, which is energy. It has to, the energy has to come in these two specific forms, ATP and NADPH. And that's why you also need the light in the light-dependent reactions to come first. The light-independent reactions accomplish the transduction of light energy into ATP energy and NADPH energy. Okay? When the Calvin cycle uses the energy of ATP and NADPH, it is going to dephosphorylate the ATP back into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And spending the NADPH coenzyme means reoxidizing it, so NADPH gets reconverted into NADP+. Well, these two lower forms of energy-carrying molecules, NADP+ and ADP, get sent back to the light-dependent reactions to be recharged with energy, ATP and NADPH. So as long as the light is shining, the energy-carrying compounds can be delivered to the Calvin cycle, and more sugar can be produced. But what I haven't mentioned is the water that's an input into the light-dependent reactions. What did I say the water is for? Right. The water is a source of electrons for the electron transport of the light-dependent reactions. Not water directly, but water that gets split into hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen that's left is simply waste material from the viewpoint of photosynthesis. That's why oxygen's coming out of the bottom. But the hydrogens from water are the source of electrons and protons. The electrons get transported down chains, and the protons get pumped by the first chain, which is why ATP gets produced. NADPH gets produced because it receives electrons and protons that were in the hydrogen of water originally. Okay, so the overall inputs, material inputs for photosynthesis are water and CO2. The other input is light, but it's not a material input. So energy, water, and carbon dioxide are the inputs. The outputs are oxygen and organic compounds in the form of sugars. G3P directly, but then it gets incorporated into other sugars. All of that occurring within a chloroplast. Now, if it's a bacterium, photosynthetic bacterium, the same thing is happening, but of course it doesn't have a chloroplast. It's just happening in the cell. And remember that a chloroplast really was just one of these bacteria originally that got engulfed and survived the process. Any questions on this or any other chapter for this unit? If not, then we're done. Just remember your Scantron on Thursday.